afternoon. This is part 7 of a series on socialism. And I'd like to start a brief review of what happened in Germany with the Pietists. They believed that a Christian was more than just acknowledging certain doctrines as scripture. They needed to have personal experience with Jesus. And when they do, their life would be changed with the indwelling power of the Holy Spirit. They would no longer do worldly things, such as going to bars, brothels, lewd theaters, or be involved in worldly government. What was that last item? Yes, government. The Pietist attitude was that if someone was truly a Christian, they wouldn't be involved in government because it was filled with worldly people. This was not the early version. This was sort of an early version of separation of church and state. But most Pietists refused to vote. In fact, some princes actually wanted to promote Pietism to keep them out of governmental affairs. The separation kept German churches silent, knowing allowing ambitious politicians like Hitler to seize power. In fact, the church must be reminded that it is the conscience of the state. The National Socialist Workers' Party usurped power, killed millions in over 1,200 concentration camps. It took the sacrifice of millions of courageous Allied forces, Allied lives, to stop what Germany church leaders refused to do because they taught church members it was more spiritual to not be involved in politics. Like many politicians, Hitler at first pretended to be sympathetic to Christianity to get elected. We see this happening today, duping naive ministers with a placating rhetoric. Once in power, he dispensed with the pretense and revealed his Nazified social Darwinism and hostility toward Christianity. Recent headlines reflect a similar hostility. China trying to rewrite the Bible, forced churches to sing communist anthems. In China, they're closing churches, jailing pastors, even rewriting scripture. China's Communist Party is intensifying religious persecution as Christianity's popularity grows. A new state translation of the Bible will establish a correct understanding of the text. One other example, Kansas public health orders allowed people to go to bars, dine in public restaurants, but denied people to gather in church with more than 10 people, even if they observed social distancing. Governor Gretchen Whitmer issued draconian lockdown orders in the state of Michigan and used state police to enforce not allowing people to go to church, but allowing abortion clinics to stay open. The mayor of Greenville, Mississippi, declared it was a crime for people to sit alone in their cars in a church parking lot. The Department of Justice said the city appears to have thereby singled churches out as the only essential service that may not operate despite the following recommendations regarding social distancing. Massachusetts governor targeted churches for shutdown rules he didn't apply to Home Depot. Franklin Roosevelt stated in December 1941 to Hitler, "The church is a monstrosity to be destroyed by any means." Roosevelt stated, "The world is too small for both Hitler and God." Nazis have now announced their plan for enforcing the pagan religion all over the world, by which the Holy Bible, the Cross of Mercy, would be displaced by Mein Kampf and the swastika. Roosevelt stated of Hitler in December of 1941, "The government to him is not the servant of the people, but the absolute master and dictator of their every act. The rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, which seemed to the founders of the Republic inalienable, were to Hitler and his fellows empty words. Hitler advanced that the individual human being has no rights whatsoever in himself, no right to a soul of his own or a mind of his own or a tongue of his own or a trait of his own or even a life where he pleases, to live where he pleases or marry the woman he loves. That is only the duty to obey the state, not to his God, not to his conscience, but to Adolf Hitler. His only value is this, as not as a man, but as a unit of Nazi state. George Orwell observed that people not only want material things, they want purpose, even if it's a false one. Attorney General Bill Barr noted in February of 2020, progressives have become increasingly militant and totalitarian. They seek power through democratic processes. The policy agenda has become more and more aggressively collectivist, socialist, explicitly revolutionary. Interesting, there's sort of a gun control hall of fame. Hitler, or Stalin, took away from his citizens guns in 1929 and then murdered 20 million of his people. And we see Pol Pot took away guns from his citizens in 1956 and then murdered 2 million of his people once defenseless. Hitler took away guns from his citizens in 1938 and then murdered 13 million of them once defenseless. And we see Mao Zedong took away guns from his citizens in 1935 and then murdered 20 million of them once defenseless. Hitler began to confiscate weapons from law-abiding citizens, a deadline set for the surrender of weapons was supposed to expire March 31st, 1933. Whoever does not belong to one of these three units, the SA, the SS, or Stahlhelm, and keeps his weapon without authorization is considered to be an enemy of the state and will be held responsible without hesitation. He will be punished most severely. Ordinary citizens, he says, don't need guns, as their having guns doesn't serve the state. Disarming the civilian population is a necessary step in state control. As Lenin explained, one man with a gun can control 100 without one. George Mason, a Virginia founding father, wrote, "To disarm the people is the best and most effectual way to enslave them." Noah Webster wrote, "Before standing an army can rule, the people must be disarmed." Theoretical arguments for disarming citizens become indefensible when faced with actual situations. Disarm North Koreans sentenced to labor camps. Disarm Nigerians killed by Islamist Boko Haram. Disarmed Iranians killed by their fundamentalist state. And disarmed Venezuelans killed by military forces of a corrupt dictator. When a suspected homosexual youth was shot, Nazi diplomat Ernst von Rath in Paris, it was used as an excuse to confiscate firearms from the Jews. This left the Jewish neighborhoods defenseless, setting the stage for the Jews to be maligned, round up, and eventually sent to concentration camps. After the war, Hans Frank was tried and executed. At the beginning of our way, we did not expect that our turning away from God could have such disastrous and deadly consequences, and that we would necessarily become more and more deeply involved in guilt. Thus, by turning away from God, we were overthrown and had to perish, because Hitler's road was the way without God, the way of turning from Christ, and in the last analysis, the way of political foolishness, the way of disaster, the way of death. Soviet infiltration tactics in Hollywood media, education, politics, business, churches, seminaries, been confirmed by Vlasy Metrokhin, senior activist for Soviet Union's foreign intelligence and the first chief director to the KGB. Time magazine's senior editor Whitaker Chambers confessed to being a Soviet spy. Chambers had joined the communist underground in 1932 and worked with spies within the Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal administration, who leaked classified documents. In 1948, Whitaker Chambers testified before the House of Un-American Activities Committee, named 18 current and former government employees who were communist spies or sympathizers. One of those was Elger Hiss, who worked in Roosevelt's Department of Justice and who helped write the United Nations Charter. He then wrote, "The communist vision is a vision of man without God. When men try to live in a world without God, it's only too easy for them to forget the rights that God bestows. Too easy to suppress freedom of speech, jail distance, and to put great thinkers in mental wards." So what about voter manipulation? As people exercise the right to vote, more tactics emerge to manipulate voters, including media ignoring, censoring, or publishing fake news about a candidate, persuading more candidates to run to divide the opposing party's voter base, getting more voters to become dependent on government entitlement handouts, fear-mongering vote that voters might lose entitlements, street money to pay people to vote, psychological projection where a candidate guilty of a crime accuses their opponent of committing it. The October surprise, which is used a lot by the Democrats the week before the November elections, including planned political attacks, ads, mailers, saved up shocking revelations, prepared breaking news stories to grab the headlines and disrupt the momentum of a winning candidate, or engineered financial distress and national emergencies intended to alter the outcome of an election. Race baiting, Black Panther, Black Lives Matters, Antifa-type violence, or intimidation at the polls, using community organizers, agitators, and Asian provocateurs to incite riots. In addition to silencing opposing viewpoints, there are many ways to manipulate the counting of votes. Joseph Stalin remarked in 1923, the memoirs of Stalin's former secretary by Boris Bashanov, I consider it completely unimportant who in the party will vote or how. But what is extraordinarily important is this, who will count the votes and how? Would politicians stoop to voter fraud? A question to ponder is if a politician can adjust an agenda, including killing unborn babies, is there anything the politician could not justify? What is lying, cheating, slander, or voter fraud compared to murder? As the restraining influence of moral virtue decreases in a country, methods of voter fraud increase. Losing ballots, voter multiple times, mail-in ballots lost, altered, or added to, delay in counting military ballots, same-day registration fraud, inaccurate ballot preparation, allowing non-citizens to vote, refusal to purge voter rolls of those who have died or moved, orchestrated computer glitches, rigging the electronic voting machines, hacking state election systems by the Department of Homeland Security and blaming it on foreign interference. False polling data published prior to an election prepares the voters to accept fraudulent election results. If by chance voter fraud is discovered, the politicians promise to investigate, and in the course of the investigation, they have the opportunity to destroy any evidence which could convict them. If the public pressure mounts, excuses are made that the fraud was unintentional, unauthorized, or a result of ineptness. Ultimately, a low-level scapegoat is blamed, allowing the politicians to stay in office. Another concern is one of parties' push for universal mail-in voting. Millions of new ballots could overload the postal system, causing the counting of them to drag on for weeks, especially if their demands for recounts and legal challenges. What happens if the counting's not done by noon, January 20th? When the 20th Amendment requires the president and vice president to vacate office. According to interpretations of the Presidential Succession Acts of 1792, the Speaker of the House would become the acting president. What we have is we need for eternal vigilance. Our abolitionist Frederick Douglass wrote in the North Star newspaper in March in 1848, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. It can only be maintained by a sacred regard for the rights of all men. Andrew Jackson stated in his farewell address on March 4, 1837, but you must remember, my fellow citizens, that eternal vigilance by the people is the price of liberty. You must pay the price if you wish to secure the blessing. Let's look at education. Socialist author Antonio Gramsci in prison. In a new order, socialism will be the triumph first by capturing the culture via infiltration of the schools, universities, churches, and the media by transforming the consciousness of society. Just like in computer terminology, there's hardware and software. A child's body and brain is the hardware, but the ideology that they're taught is the software, which gives them the identity and purpose. Just as the Bible, in one aspect, is like behavior software program, love your neighbors, yourself, love your enemies, etc. So atheistic socialism is like a software virus. The battle for a future is over who gets to load the software on the next generation's brains. Malware, viruses, and computer-computed corrupted files loaded on children's brains produce narcissistic selfish behavior. Students must abandon their parents' morals and adopt ever-evolving government-dictated beliefs. Yale president Timothy Dwight, grandson of the famous preacher Jonathan Edwards, who wrote Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, he warned that Voltaire's atheistic agenda included controlling education. Education of the youth. Books replete with infidelity, irreligion, immorality, and obscenity. We're always more tempted by what we've experienced. And they know that if you can bring bad experiences, immorality, obscenity, various lewdness into the minds of young people, they will become addicted to some of that. Our schools have been scientifically designed to prevent over-education from happening. The average American should be content with their humble role in life. They're not tempted to think about their other role. John Dewey wrote in the middle works in 1915, he said, education, which trains children to docility and obedience, to the careful performance of imposed tasks because they are imposed, regardless of where they lead, is suited to an autocratic society. These are the traits needed in a state where there is one head to plan and care for the lives and institutions of the people. Marx stated, the education of all children from the moment they get along without their mother's care shall be the state institutions done at state institutions at state expense. Antonio Gramsci wrote, before puberty, the child's personality has yet been formed, and it's easier to guide its life and make it acquire specific habits of order, discipline, and work. Lenin stated, give me 4 years to teach children, and the seed I have sown will never be uprooted. Stalin stated, education is a weapon whose effects depends on who holds it in his hands and at whom it is aimed. Communist Party Education Workers Congress stated in 1918, we must create out of the younger generation a generation of communists. We must turn children who can be shaped like wax into real good communists. We must remove the children from the crude influence of their families. We must take them over and, to speak frankly, nationalize them. From the first days of their lives, they will be under healthy influence of communist children's nurseries, schools. They will grow up to be real communists. Hitler stated on November 6, 1933, when an opponent declares, I will not come over to your side, I calmly say your children belongs to us already. Who are you? You will pass on. Your descendants, however, now stand in the new camp. In a short time, they will know nothing else but the new community. And this new Reich will give its youth to no one, but will itself take youth and give to youth its own education and its own upbringing. Representative Albert Herlong Jr. read into the U.S. Congressional Record January 10, 1963, a list of communist goals, which included discredit the family as an institution, emphasize the need to raise children away from the negative influence of parents, control schools, use them as transmission belts for socialism and current communist propaganda, soften the curriculum, get control of teachers' associations, put party line in textbooks, gain control of all student newspapers, belittle all forms of American culture and discourage the teaching of American history, discredit the American founding fathers. Edgar Hoover wrote in 1954, secularization advances when men forget God. In Paris, John Adams wrote in his diary in 1778, in vain our schools, academics, and universities instituted who lose principles and licentious habits are impressed upon children in their earliest years. The vices and examples of parents cannot be concealed from the children. How is it possible that children can have any just sense of sacred obligations of morality or religion if, from their earliest infancy, their fathers are in a constant infidelity to their mothers? Henry A. Giroux wrote, childhood ideals increasingly give way to market-driven politics in which young people are prepared for a life of objectification. In other words, to treat a person as a thing that will simultaneously drain them of any viable sense of morality or political agency. Dr. James Dobson addressed the National Religious Broadcasters in February of 2002. He said, if you can get control of the children, they can change the whole culture in one generation. There is a concerted effort to manipulate the minds of kids. Progressive utopians are criminals. They are genocidal psychopaths who have killed more human beings in the last 100 years than any other ideology in history. They don't limit their murder just to an individual, but to entire nations. As a National Socialist Germany's war against anti-communists, Cambodia's slaughter of uneducated middle class, the communist China's cultural war, all this was done in the name of creating a new utopian society. In the United States, the socialist utopians adopted a new unique method of conquering a nation by dumbing down its people, by destroying the brain power of millions of its citizens. The plan to dumb down America was launched in 1898 by socialist John Dewey, outlined in an essay titled The Primary Education Fetish. In it, he showed his fellow progressives how to transform America into a collectivist utopia by taking over the public schools and destroying the literacy of millions. The plan has been so successfully implemented that it is now a fact of American adult population are functionally illiterate. They can't read the nation's Constitution or Declaration of Independence. Many of them can't read their own diplomas. The method of achieving this was by changing the way children are taught in schools. The utopians got rid of the traditional intensive phonics by which you can learn tens of thousands of words by sounding them out. But they used a whole word method that was used for people who were deaf. They couldn't sound the words out. It was tried in Boston for 6 months. It was such a total failure that they rejected it. But Dewey saw this as a way of keeping education at a very low level. A person couldn't read, he couldn't learn. He couldn't learn thousands of things. Reading is an individual practice, something that you can do, and you can get on with the mind of the author and on an individual basis. But if you can't read, then you're not going to be able to do that with thousands of different subjects. John Adams said the Native American who cannot read back then is as rare as the appearance of a comet or an earthquake. Yet federal literacy in 1993 stated 55% of Americans were functionally illiterate, and that's after huge amounts of money has been spent. Dumbing down a nation was and is the purpose of overthrowing the government. It involves deliberately harming the minds of children, pornographic sex education, even in kindergarten, promoting atheism, nihilism, evolutionism, which many times results in addiction, suicide, and homicide. Horace Mann, a socialist and humanist, went to Prussia and brought back the whole word method, which was used for deaf people because they couldn't hear the sound which the phonics uses. This was the total failure after 6 months in Boston produced dyslexia, permanent reading disability, brain damage in healthy children. Rudolf Fetisch wrote a book called The Deliberate Dumbing Down. He wrote a book called Why Johnny Can't Read. He found that teaching the reading all over the United States in all schools, in all textbooks, is wrong and flies in the face of logic and common sense. Do you know that there are no remedial reading classes in Austrian schools, in German schools, in France, in Italy, in Norway, in Sweden, or in Spain, or anywhere in the world except the United States? Did you know that there was no such thing as remedial reading in the United States until we switched to this present method in 1925? When the progressives took over the American education at the beginning of the 1900s, their goal was to use schools as a means of changing America from a capitalist, individualist, believing nation into a socialist, collectivist, atheistic, humanistic nation. The purpose of whole language is to get rid of individualism. Of course, as I said, reading is not, as a whole language, people claim, a social or collectivist activity. There was a lady, Charlotte Iserby, who under the Reagan administration was in the Department of Education, which actually was started by Jimmy Carter. It's a communist organization because it's a way of controlling the minds of the youth of a whole nation. Well, she was found out exactly what their agenda was, and she wrote it down and gave it to the Humanist magazine, a conservative newspaper, and as a result, she got fired, but she'd taken all of this stuff out and saved it before she gave it to the news, the conservative news. And so then she wrote a book called The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, which documents all of this and what their agenda was. Behind the constructivist approach to history, the evolutionist approach to biology, the Marxist view of economics, the multiculturalism, tolerance, values clarification, integrated math, and outcome-based education is an atheistic worldview. But around 85% of Christian parents send their children to these humanistic indoctrination centers we call public schools. Worldviews are not inherited, they're learned. Many students absorb a secular worldview from the classroom simply because the parents don't reinforce a biblical worldview at home. Many historians, philosophers, and scientists claim objectivity in their chosen field, and many Americans adapt the idea that basic educational skills and facts can be taught without a religious or philosophical bias. Well, Robert L. Dabney, in his book Secularized Education, explained the impossibility of neutrality in education. The instructor has to teach history, cosmology, the study of origins, psychology, ethics, the law of nations. How can he do it without saying anything favorably or unfavorably about the beliefs of evangelical Christians, Catholics, Unitarians, deists, pantheists, materialists, fetish worshippers, or all who claim the rights under American constitutions? His teaching will indeed be the play of Hamlet with the part of Hamlet omitted. Howard Zinn's A People's History in the United States has sold more than 2.5 million copies. It is published, pushed by Hollywood celebrities, defended by university professors who should know better, and assigned in high school and college classrooms to reach students that American history is nothing more than a litany of oppression, slavery, and exploitation. This is wrong. In debunking Howard Zinn, Mary Graber showed how Columbus was not a genocidal maniac and was, in fact, a defender of the Indians. Why the American Indians were not feminist, communist, sexual revolutionaries ahead of their time, how the United States was founded to protect liberty, not white men's ill-gotten wealth. Why Americans of the greatest generation were not the equivalent of Nazi war criminals, how the Viet Cong were not well-meaning community leaders advocating for local self-rule, and why the Black Panthers were not civil rights leaders. Zinn used dishonest rhetorical tricks such as reliance upon partisan history, explicit rejection of historical balance, and selective quoting of sources to make them say exactly the opposite of what they were intended to say. History, after all, is the memory of a nation. Just as a memory enables a person to learn, choose goals, stick to them to avoid making the same mistake again, in short, to grow, so history is a means by which a nation establishes its sense of identity and purpose. If history is a nation's memory, then America has national Alzheimer's. The Durants wrote in their book Lessons from History in 1968, said a civilization is not inherited. It has to be learned and earned by each generation anew. If transmission should be interrupted, civilization would die. We would be savages again. Reagan warned in the Phoenix Chamber of Commerce in May 1961, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. The only way we can inherit the freedom we have known is if we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it on to them with well-thought lessons of how they, in their lifetime, must do the same. And if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like to be an American when we were free. Education has a political basis for social change and has been used for that. The new federal education curriculum introduced in 1994 called Goals 2000 included multiculturalism, values clarification, evolution, and tolerance. School to Work Initiative was also passed in 1994, and the Workforce Investment Act followed in 1998. Nations were to be taxed to support the United Nations militia, which would potentially maintain peace, and disputes were to be settled in a world court. To assure that the environment would survive, pollution was to be reduced, natural resources conserved, and wetlands preserved. Control of public schools was to be mainly in the hands of the state and federal government. The 5 points of control were compulsory attendance, curriculum, teacher certification, school accreditation, and school funding. One of the components of Goals 2000 was outcome-based education, later called profile of learning. In other words, they had a certain outcome they wanted the students to believe. And so if that didn't work, they would change the input so that the students would believe that particular outcome. So the profile of learning kept faster students from achieving more than the slowest students could achieve, but slowed down the faster ones so they would all be going at the same pace. Liberal bias in textbooks was common knowledge prior to 1994. However, with Goals 2000, students were assessed as to the level of agreement with these biases. the NAEP tests were based on student values. Knowledge was given, then called in terms of low standards, but attitudes and values were called high standards. So that was what they were basically going for, was their attitudes. In 1989, Shirley McCune was a U.S. Department of Education, and she was speaking at the National Governors Conference on Education. She stated, "What we are into is total restructuring of society. What it means for education is that we no longer see teaching facts and information as the primary outcome of education. The second initiative, called School to Work, had students choose their career during their eighth grade. If they didn't choose a career was chosen for them. Education focused on acquiring job skills for a state-managed economy. School to Work and workforce investment were designed around economic development and human resources, not the needs of the student for his success in life. This third initiative, the Workforce Investment Act, passed in 1998 on a Friday night with only five members left in the Senate chamber. The reason that Workforce Investment Act did not pass in 1994, because it was so controversial before 1998. The system reorganized government around appointed, not elected officials. The National Center for Center on Education and Economy, headed by Mark Tucker, a friend of Hillary Clinton, was responsible for three initiatives, which became the blueprint for the transformation of education and economy. Tucker stated, "America's approaches have served us well in the past, but they will not serve us well in the future. The problem in the United States is that there are too many people in college, not enough qualified workers. The Secretary's Commission on Achieving Necessary Skills produced what is called smaller learning communities that train students only to the level which they needed to perform a certain job. The system was piloted in Arkansas. The government would determine a sustainable salary for each job, which was defined as above poverty level. Students are taught from kindergarten on that the federal government is responsible to set prices, ensure a sustainable income. The philosophy changed from everyone based on ability to everyone based on need. The change philosophy is socialist and opposed to free enterprise. History is a living laboratory of the two systems." So that is the end of our first session, and thank you for listening.